How addicted are you to your smartphone? Well, if you're like me, you've got it from the time you wake up to the time you go to sleep. And if you ever put it somewhere and you don't know where it is, you probably go crazy thinking you lost your phone. We wanted to find out a little more about how dependent we are on our smartphones. And so we brought together a panel, and here's that conversation. Joining me now are Julie Albright, a digital sociologist and lecturer at USC. Alon Schwartz is the founder of Unglue. That's an app that helps you limit computer screen time. And Alan Silberberg is the CEO of cybersecurity firm DigiJax. Where'd you get that name?
Just basically a way of combining hijacking and digital.
Oh. And what was the goal when you started that?
To try to educate everyone from government agencies to corporations about how to be safe in a digital world, and to provide some tools to actually maybe give some early warnings of what's
coming. And not
coming.
Get hijacked.
Yeah, exactly. Or try not to.
Yeah, because that happens with incredible frequency.
And more so.
Do you have any data on that?
In terms of how much is happening?
Yeah, that's crazy. I'm getting a fake a friend request almost every day or every other day from somebody.
We know one form, social engineering, accounts for over 50% of all cybersecurity incidents now. That includes everything from phishing, you know, someone pretending to be your boss asking you to send a wire transfer at 4:30 in the afternoon on a Friday afternoon, you know, all the way up to something where it's highly detailed and targeted, you know, where someone or a company or a nation state has spent some time and resources to actually compile a database about you, and from different resources, maybe from previous hacks that have where things have been stolen, and also from publicly available information, they put it together, and then it's really about how well can you craft an email so that that one person will open it and read it.
Well, when I talk about getting fake friend requests with frequency, what I'm talking about is requests from people that are already friends, whose accounts have been stolen or hijacked, and now somebody else is trying to pull me into their web, and by friending somebody who I would
trust.
Know and trust,
yes.
But I already have as a friend, and I know it, so I know that somebody else is trying to pull the wool over my eyes, and immediately I'll just destroy them. Off the island you go.
And that's not always because of a hack. It could be because they might have used an app on Facebook, for example, that shares all that information to the developer.
So yeah, but frequently I'll ask people that I know, did you get hacked, and they'll say yes. Hmm. So in most of the cases I'm running into, it is a hack, and it's very frustrating, but I've come to learn how to deal with that. But I'm betting that there are a lot of people, Alon, that aren't aware of that.
Yeah, most people are not aware of that. Most people just trust social media, they trust YouTube, they trust
Why do we trust them?
Because it's easy. It's easy to trust. You rather trust someone than not trust someone, typically. We started to evolve into this generation where media, social media, the entire internet is part of our life, and we expect it to be part of our life. Everything needs to be fast, immediately. We expect, you know, Amazon to ship things for us. You know, 2 days is too late. Now it's 1 day. Now it's, you know, over the air immediately using a drone. We just like it. We like it where it's easy, where it's free, where it's common, and just it's easier to believe things than not believing them.
We have a whole generation of people that are people who are connected to their phones 24 hours a day, but I can remember back to when I didn't have such a device, and I don't know how I got along without it. I mean, that's oftentimes what we say, isn't it? That, you know, I have a computer in my hand, I can look up anything, I can Google something at a moment's notice, and I can take a picture when I want to because I've got a phone with a camera in my hand, and all of a sudden our life changed.
Yeah, there's a de-skilling effect that comes along with that. People are using Waze, or they're using Google Maps or something to navigate, for example, and young people are losing these skills. 3 out of 4 young people now do not know how to read a paper map.
That's a frightening statistic.
Yeah. So the thing is, it creates dependencies as well. Dependencies where if that device is suddenly gone, you're lost, or you don't know how to get home, or you don't know how to navigate the world, be it getting dinner to groceries to whatever it may be. So that's the key thing, is that we're becoming more and more dependent on these for more and more things.
You're a sociologist.
I am.
So try to help me understand what's happened here. I mean, young people, and I have young people, but young people seem to feel that our world as it was is not the world they want to be part of. They get their information from the internet, from sources like Facebook. They tend to rely on things like Reddit, media that us grown-ups don't necessarily go to. Well, what's happened here?
Well, you've got a generation now, first of all, a generation that's grown up with the internet, but now younger kids have grown up with a world that there always was mobility. In other words, there always were iPads or iPhones or different kinds of laptops and all these things. So they've grown up in that world. In fact, now, if you go on YouTube and search baby with iPad, you're going to come up with thousands, literally tens of thousands of examples. Kids are now developing digital skills before they're acquiring language.
Now, there's got to be an upside to that, because they're getting smarter, they're getting more informed, they're stimulated all the time, so their mind is in an area that maybe not in gangs or this or that or the other. However, there is a dark side. So before we go to the dark side, let's talk about the light side.
Yeah, I think it's important to keep in memory that technology is not bad. It's not evil. There's nothing really inherently wrong with technology and devices. We keep, you know, like to vilify the iPhone. That's the cause of all evil that ever happened. That's not true, right? Technology is great. Information is great. We'd rather live in a world where we know more, where we can share more, where we can investigate and just Google everything, and everything is out there. So technology inherently is not bad. It's how we use it and how frequently we use it. That's where it becomes a problem. So this, you know, a device, a smartphone, this is the first thing you see when you wake up and the last thing you see when you go to sleep. It's not your wife or husband or kids. It's that device that's in your pocket literally almost 24/7, because most people use it also as an alarm clock. God forbid we buy an alarm clock.
Well, you can't sleep. You play a game.
You play a game.
You read. You listen to music.
Exactly.
The president.
You text with somebody.
The president gets on Twitter at 5 in the morning.
Right. You want to read that tweet. Right. It's very important, right? So it is. There's nothing wrong with technology. It's really, we need to put limits. It's like, you know, I like to compare it to fast food. You know, fast food was great. We loved it. It's cheap. It's fast. It's yummy. It's everywhere. And you can just eat it nonstop until we realize it's actually not good for us to have so much fast food. Same thing with technology. It's great, but there are limits that we need to put on ourselves.
There's a rule or an algorithm. There's something out there. I forget the name of it, that says that every so many months or years, technology changes. And changes exponentially?
Moore's Law.
Yes. Moore's Law. That's what it is. Yeah, it Moore's Law. Mm-hmm. Explain that.
Well, it's that the computing power is going up and the price is going down, in short. So what we have in our hands now, years ago, would have been in a whole giant room, a huge mainframe computer. So the computing power the average person has now is just, it's unbelievable if you look at the beginning of computing.
It's remarkable to me. And so when we talk about the light side, we talk about the things that are positive that people can get. But let's go to the dark side for a moment, because there's a lot that can really get you in trouble there.
Well, you know, it's like with any technology, there's a double-edged sword. I mean, you develop the technology to do one thing, and then other people start to think of ways in which they can use it. And because all of us have shifted our lives into this sort of digital sphere, that means our money has shifted into the digital sphere as well. So the criminals are basically just going, you know, the old adage, go where the money is. So the criminals have done that, and they've done it in multiple ways. So there's individuals, there's like hacking cartels that are basically similar in function to a drug cartel, but they have, you know, teams of hackers who go out and they distribute malware, or they do ransomware, or, you know, they hack people's devices, and that's all they do. And then you have the nation state organizations, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, who are using resources that the average person would never have access to. They might be using hundreds or thousands of people, mainframe computers, supercomputers, often tied to satellites and geospatial technology. So the targeting of the sort of the bad stuff, it used to be that it was a scattershot approach, you know, where someone was taking a shotgun and sort of seeing what they could hit. Now it's like a laser. And so if a criminal wants to go after a specific person, it can happen.
The thing I find amazing, and this just happened to me this past week, criminals are really bold. I mean, they have really gotten bold. I don't know how much the digital world plays into this, but these people that will call you up on the phone and tell you that they're going to come by and take you to jail if you don't pay so much money because you are behind in your taxes. I got one this week, and I've done stories on this before, so you know I understand what all this is about. But I got a call this week. It was from a phone number in Mexico. It actually was a phone number on my screen in Mexico, and a very English speaking person told me that he had news or information about my spouse, and my spouse was going to be in serious trouble. I don't remember if I heard the word arrest or not. And he had to talk to me specifically about my spouse. And so what I did was I said, well, here, let me put you on the speakerphone because I want all my colleagues to hear this. And by the way, in California, I have to inform you, because we're a two notification state, I have to inform you I'm recording everything you're saying. Please go ahead. And he continued to try to convince me that he had some dirt on my wife. Now, here's the deal. The deal is nobody, folks, listen to me, no agency, IRS, DEA, none of them are coming after you on a phone call. They're coming to your door. They're sending you a classified letter. They are not calling you on the phone. I don't care how realistic they sound with dispatchers in the background, which is what I heard on one of them. Actually, I can't even believe how sophisticated one was that we got, had my wife in tears because she thought it was real that they were coming by the house. We hadn't done anything wrong. Why would you do it? But they will. They made it so realistic, so dramatic, that you almost believe them. Now, in the old days when we didn't have smartphones, you'd never actually meet a crook or a bad person like that, unless they had a gun in your face, unless they were trying to grab your purse or your wallet. That's the only time you'd ever see it. Now they call you.
Yeah, it's telemarketing for criminals, right? I mean, that's pretty
How bold is that?
Absolutely.
Well, what the hell?
Well, some of the ransomware groups actually have support teams so that, like, if you're out there trying to use their ransomware to collect ransom and you run into a problem with it, you can call the help desk, you know, during business hours, and someone will actually walk you through, you know, how to fix your malware so that you can actually cause damage on somebody.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've had people, I use Apple, but I've had people call me and say, hey, I'm with Microsoft and you have problems with your computer. Well, I don't have a Microsoft computer. I don't know what the heck you're talking about. Yeah. So sociologists, how did we get here to where the bad people are so bold, they call you?
They do call, and you know, another aspect too is online, there's so much of our personal information, our marital status. You know, you'd mentioned, you know, there's lonely hearts on Facebook, for example, and there are criminal groups in Africa and other places that are targeting lonely hearts, for example, and they're seeing this person is single, and so they're stealing people's profile pictures, usually strapping young firefighters like we saw earlier today, or army men that happen to be stationed overseas, so they can't really go on a date very easily, and they'll lure them in and get them to send money. It's a way to pull them in with love, but then they start saying, oh, I got injured, I need $5,000 for a hospital and things like that.
Oh, yeah. No, I've talked to friends recently who, a couple of them actually were really worried that the person that supposedly got hurt was really hurt, but they weren't.
Yeah.
It's all a big scam. It's all a big play. And, you know, and the other thing is pornographers have really gotten the business of having women send friendships. And I suspect this goes with the guys, too, for that part of the sector. But they send you friendships, and then when you study a little bit about their about, you find out that they have some X-rated website. And they're not trying to be your friends. They're trying to be your they want you to be their client is what that is. And so, I mean, all of a sudden, I've got more friends that are in porn I've never seen before. I don't understand what's going on with that.
Well, that's the thing, too. And I think, you know, when we talk about kids and teens, especially in the vulnerabilities there, you know, sometimes they've gotten girls on webcams who think they're maybe meeting a boyfriend or something to undress and things like that, and then they're taking screenshots and asking for ransom or otherwise I'm going to post your photo and things like that. So there's all kinds of new vulnerabilities that are opening up now that we need to teach kids about, especially and people what those are and how to recognize them.
So all four of us have talked about this notion of digital addiction, and not everybody would use the term addiction, but to me, anytime that you're doing something excessively probably means you are somewhat, if not completely, addicted to it. That could be, you know, alcohol, that could be drugs, that could be sex, that could be any number of things, including smartphones. You can be addicted right to looking at these all the time because you're afraid you're going to miss something.
Right, absolutely.
How bad is that?
I mean, it is very bad. And by the way, I'm delighted at using the term digital addiction, because a few years ago, when we started, you know, talking about this, it was not a term that was used. It was a term that was, you know, scoffed about. This is not a real addiction. Well, now there's enough research out there, proof, even the larger companies, you know, Facebook and, you know, Instagram, Snapchat and others, that have admitted that this is, you know, does create an addiction. Yeah. So and it's not just, you know, again, smartphone. You can be addicted to gaming, which is now being
classified, or
social media. And gaming is actually being defined as a disease, an addiction, as a medical addiction.
Well, I think, you know, gaming has always been an issue. Even, you know, when they started the lottery here in California, one of the first things that happened was that agencies that deal with addiction were putting out notices, you know, don't play if you can't control it. But this idea of, you know, the smartphone being your universe and you have to be dancing in it all the time.
Mm-hmm. Here's the funny thing. In one interview, they interviewed you know, the CEO of Netflix, and they asked him, what is Netflix's biggest competition? And he said sleep, right? So, which is, he was partially, you know, joking, but really the reality is that's the reality. I mean, people go to sleep at 2-3 in the morning, you know, binge watch. I'm not talking about just kids. I'm talking about adults.
Oh, binge
as well.
Watching is, that's great.
Social media is the same.
Love binge watching.
People disappear.
I watch more Hal Eisner stories in a row than you've ever seen.
Case in point, Exhibit A right here.
You gotta watch myself,
you
know? Yeah. No, but I'm serious. I mean, I do like binge watching. I do like watching episodes of certain series, episode after episode. It's like watching a movie.
But even something
for 12
like,
hours.
But
for
even something hours, like binge watching, you know, what you're also doing is you're allowing multiple companies to profile you, because by binge watching, you're triggering several algorithms at once. You're triggering the algorithm in Netflix or whatever one you're watching, and then other server companies that might support it. And those go into the profiling and the modeling that then comes out the other way. You know, when someone tries a ransom attack or something, you know, they break into your computer, or even identity theft often is now coming out directly out of people getting enough information from the online world because of whatever our habits are. I mean, look, a few years ago, the average American citizen would probably have roughly 8,000 to 9,000 data points a day being created about them just by how they live their lives and the thing. Now it's probably more closer to 20,000 data points per day per person. That's being collected in servers and server farms all around the world. The real question is, so when you get past Google or Facebook or Microsoft or, you know, an American company, what is going on with that data sitting in a third world country, or it's owned by some shadowy LLC that's literally only a name on paper?
What is a data point?
So every time you use your phone, every time you screen, every time you scroll, every single touch point, everything, every time you like something, every picture.
Is that like key clicks?
Everything. It's all being collected. So your interests, your likes, like how many times a day you're looking at your wife's photographs, how many times a day you're looking at your dog, you know, just all those things, it all gets aggregated.
Will my wife
together.
Find out if I'm looking at the dog more than her?
It depends on, I guess, on who's hacking you.
Well, I could be in the doghouse.
For sure.
No, I, you know, so everything that we do, every little itty bitty, teeny tiny thing that we do can be measured and can be communicated to somebody
else. It
actually
is. It is measured. Not just can be, but it is measured and collected, more importantly. So, and the real question is, who's collecting it? Is it the government? Is it a third-party company? Is it, you know, China, Russia, Iran?
It is important to know that most of these companies, you know, Facebook for sure, Google as well, do allow you to export the data they have collected on you. And you can see, for example, where have you been? The amount of data that they collect. I mean, they know.
I'm afraid to look.
You should be.
You should look. You should
be very scared.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they can see, like on a map, everywhere, as long as you have a phone with you, they can see everywhere you've been, where you traveled, every search you ever made. I mean, those companies know more about you than your wife and kids put together.
That's frightening.
But that's the reality. Well, and that's the good and bad. Now, the good part is that they can target exactly the type of products that you want and save you on searching. The bad thing is that you just open your phone and just, well, I just talked about this topic, and how do they know that?
It almost feels to me like if you're going to have a smartphone, you're going to have to give up something.
Absolutely.
You're not going to be able to have it 100% the way you want it. Well, Facebook didn't start off as a subscription service.
Right.
They started off as a service that's free, and we'll put some ads in there, and we'll do whatever we're going to have to do to make money. But they didn't charge you for it. And so whenever you do something that nobody's charging you for, you got to figure there's a hitch somewhere.
Yeah, they say if it's free, then you're the product.
You are the product.
Yeah.
For that's sure. A good way. That's
yeah, we
good
are.
Way.
We are all the product.
Yeah. We're the product.
Yeah.
But you know, people don't think about sold. It. But a lot of times, you know, we focus on these larger companies. But one of the real problems is that all of us who have a smartphone have hundreds of apps on these phones, games, you know, money, travel, and a lot of the apps are actually built with techniques where the microphone can be turned on remotely without anyone knowing, without any light coming on. Facebook has admitted that they do this. Instagram does it. You know, WhatsApp, obviously you can't use WhatsApp without talking. But there are many games and apps that will trigger that microphone without you ever knowing it. So then that gets into whole privacy issue, family safety, you know, business safety, government safety, you really national security. I mean, you really get into a whole level of stuff. What happens when everybody walks into a room and someone's bugging the whole room just because they have their phone on?
Well, people can actually hack into your computer and look through your camera, which is why there are people, like one of our technical directors here at Fox 11, who puts tape, masking tape, over the camera.
Yeah, we use duct tape in my house.
You use duct tape, yeah, to be able to keep somebody Absolutely. From seeing through. I just find that amazing that anybody would do that.
Unfortunately, it's all too common.
Is it? And is it really that common?
Yeah, because it's super easy, because most of these apps were created with these backdoors. And unless the manufacturers actually take the effort to patch them or, you know, release a new version of the app without that backdoor that allows you to turn on the microphone or camera, then they're there. And most of the time, the apps simply won't even admit that they do that.
I wonder how hard it would be to get a clamshell phone. I'm starting to think about that.
Very easy, and probably we should. And I think it's something we have to just realize and admit to ourselves that once you have a personal, if you're connected to the internet, you have to some degree forego your privacy. And just accept that. And you can turn it off when you want, go into airplane mode to just, you know, keep your privacy. But at the end of the day, the concept of privacy that we knew years ago, 10, 20 years ago and before, has just changed and disappeared. And it doesn't mean that we're completely naked, but certain level of privacy that we accepted is just no longer the case, and that's just it.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's just stunning to think about the possibilities and the probabilities. I mean, you know, I am not uncomfortable being a very public person. I'm not, and I don't have tape on my laptop camera, and I'm not really afraid of people knowing who I am or about me. Maybe now I'm getting nervous because of what you're saying,
but second thoughts,
right? But I think I have come to learn that the phone and I are for the most part friends, and it does what I need it to do, and the applications help me do the things I need to do. And I only have 40,000 pictures in my phone, so the camera is very, very helpful.
Only.
So I mean, you know, but there is a good and there is a bad. So let's go from there to, should we be taking a digital day off? Yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I saw a recent study that we were talking about earlier that people, the last thing they see is their phone, and the majority of young people now are sleeping with their phone. And many of them are texting after going to bed. In fact, the average is 30 texts or messages after going to bed. So on a global scale now, as a result, there's a global sleep deprivation going on, which has other implications. So when you think about that, you know, it may be as simple as moving the phone and charging it, for example, for children in the parents' bedroom or in another room away from the children, knowing that they'll be on that phone literally all night long if it's in the same room. So things like that can be a good digital hygiene.
But what about just putting the phone in the drawer for a day?
Yeah, so
that works.
But does it?
Well, you have to turn it off. You can't just put in the dream. You actually have to turn the phone off.
Yeah, but I mean, how hard is that to do? For some people, it would be absolutely impossible.
So I've wrote a lot about this, and one day I decided to do it for a week. Not a day, a week, where I turned my phone into just a telephone, right? Which I know is shocking that this actually is a telephone. And for a week, I did not have, could not read emails on the phone, nothing. It was simply just so I can text my wife and accept phone calls. And yes, it was insanely difficult. There are certain apps that you just can't live without. I mean, certain apps like Facebook, I was happy to not have access to, but other ones like Audible when I'm listening to, or podcasts when I'm listening to while I'm driving, especially in LA, it's a must. Well, it's very hard. So there's a good thing and a bad thing. What it taught me is that I immediately removed social media from my phone. It's perfectly fine for me to look at Facebook or Instagram in the evening after my kids go to sleep and just respond and like people then. It doesn't have to be immediately. Nothing bad will happen.
Are you sure?
Absolutely, I'm sure.
I'm just checking.
None of my friends were disappointed that you did not immediately like their photos or my family. Yeah, I mean, I definitely encourage everyone to try it for a day or two and just see, because it's an immediate filter for you to see what is really important and what is not. And at the end of the day, it's just like a regular, typical, fast for a day. You immediately understand what's important, what's not important. It helps your brain calibrate. It's a detoxing way. It is hard, especially in our day and age when we're all working, we need an email and a Slack and a text and everything else to be active because everyone expects you to respond immediately or something's wrong with you. But it definitely helps you to calibrate your life. Absolutely.
Well, I would add just real quickly that one easy way is to turn the device off at night completely, not to silent, but literally turn off the power, power it down.
Won't ring in the morning.
Yeah, but then you can't just wake up and grab your phone first thing and look before you even get out of bed. I mean, so it's sort of like a self-control issue. I mean, how much self-control do you exhibit?
What do you mean when you first get up out of bed? What about when you get up three times during the night and go to the bathroom? You need to look at your phone.
I actually don't know what to say to that one.
And that's why we need to unglue ourselves. I mean, we are really addicted. And again, we're joking about this, but we also joked about us binge watching, and there are only 24 hours in a day, right? And average kids and adults spend roughly 8 to 9 hours on and off throughout the day in front of their device, in front of different screens. Right. That 8 hours was not there 10, 12, 15 years ago. So we didn't gain 8 more hours in the day, right? The day is not longer. We just gave up some other things that we used to do. If it's working out, if it's just being in nature, it's being with our family. And I'm guilty as everyone else, right? I'm not trying to pretend like I'm better, but it is a daily battle. So that time, we shouldn't just accept that. We should claim our time back. And it's not that we're doing it because we want to. Most times we're being encouraged, manipulated, I would even say, by those apps, by those websites, so it's typically apps, to watch more, to click more, to scroll more, to just one more. How long? And like episodes started automatically. You don't have to do anything. Just yawn for 10 seconds, and the next episode starts. And out of a sudden, it's 3 in the morning. You're red eye. You have to wake up at 6. Oh, honey, what happened? Just happened to you. Just happened to me, right? I mean, this is a typical day in the life of all of us.
It's just such an interesting thing because I come from an entirely different generation. I was born when Theodore Roosevelt was president.
Quiet.
That's a joke. Why did you all look like you were believing me? What's up with that? No.
We tried to do the math in our
head.
That
is not true. Theodore Roosevelt. Come on. Come on.
T-Rex was running
around.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. So the president I remember most as a kid was Dwight Eisenhower and then Kennedy and going on. But it was a different world. It was Pleasantville, right? It was a different world. And as the world continued to change, as I continued to grow up, technology came along with the television and the stereo and this and that and the Walkman. And I mean, all this great technology. And it was like, well, how could we possibly live without those things? It's so amazing how technology has, first of all, developed. Second of all, it becomes such a critical part of what we do all the time. And where's it going next?
Yeah.
Where is it going next?
When I went to USC to start my doctorate, I said I wanted to look at the impact of computing on society because I saw that it was going to have a big impact. And they said to me, what does that have to do with sociology? And, you know, at the time, and I thought, oh, my gosh, you know. But now, you know, just walk down any street, and people are looking at devices on in every city. And even in the farthest flung areas now, there are more cell phone devices than toilets in certain parts of the world. So you can go to the furthest island anywhere in the world now, and you're going to see these devices.
That's quite a commentary. There's more phones than there are toilets.
Yeah.
I don't know what to think about that.
Well,
exactly.
I was at the beach the other day, and the beach was literally filled with people. We're having a huge heat wave right now. And, you know, I would say two-thirds of the people at the beach were literally looking at their devices or playing with something, or they had the headphones in. And, you know, the other third were out running around and actually enjoying the beach. But there was this two-thirds of the people who were stuck to their devices.
So what do you think the next great thing is going to be? Is it going to be holograms? What's it going to be?
We definitely know that. So before we talk about it, there are over 700 million iPhones and over a billion Android phones. So this is just phones without iPads, without computers. So the numbers are massive, right? And no other company in history has managed to, you know, Facebook actually has 2.2 billion people under their platform. So those numbers of people that under those companies control, I would say, or influence is massive. I mean, these are like the biggest countries in the world, right? I mean, you know, Facebook is by far the biggest country in the world when it comes to how many people.
Interesting to put it in that perspective. So that it's like a country.
Which will actually, you know, should lead us to talk about their responsibility.
All right, go there. What is their responsibility?
We definitely, when it comes to any kind of social media, there has to be some responsibility put on these companies to do better, to make sure that whatever they're posting, because it's not just social media, it's social media and news now. And now when we know everyone can just see, everyone can post, and it can change our minds so easily, there has to be certain responsibility upon these companies to do better, to do more.
So how do you do that in a world where people want to keep the internet free?
I mean, it can be free. I mean, if you look at Google, for example, I mean, for the most part, there are billions of adult websites and images and videos, but you can't find them, for the most part, on Google. Google has done a lot of work to make sure you can find adult content when you search. And typically, if you search any type of word, you will find some adult content you could have. So Google has solved this problem. This is a solvable problem from a technology standpoint. It can be done. The only question is, you know, do they want to do it?
Willpower. It takes the willpower of the executives and the investors to push it. And then you have to really need often an activist board. You have to have a board that's willing to stand up to the CEO and say, you know, maybe now's the time to make some real changes here because your product, these people, is the size of the largest country on Earth.
Well, yeah, and that's the other thing when we're talking about these networks. The reason that some of the fake news and disinformation has been spreading is because we're in these trust network situations. So if suddenly the information isn't trustworthy and the people aren't trustworthy, what happens is suddenly the consumers begin to see the platform is not trustworthy. And that's where it breaks down, and that's where the financial blowback will happen towards the Facebooks. So they have an interest in the long run, I believe, to addressing this problem, the provenance of data, where it comes from, and the provenance of identity. Who are these people?
So I would say that absolutely, I completely agree. I mean, those companies have to do something, but we shouldn't let, just like we don't let McDonald's have the responsibility to limit the obesity, you know, problem we have here. I mean, they do serve salad, but that's what they do, most likely probably from a PR problem-solving standpoint. Those companies should also open the platforms for other companies. For example, when I have a Windows computer, for example, I can put any antivirus I want. If I use Facebook, I would like to use, I'm sure there can be a lot of other companies that build a fake news detector, for example. That let me, should I wait for Facebook to build it, or should Facebook open their platform? Should Apple open the platform and let
Well, who makes those decisions?
Well, those executives. I mean, it starts from the
board and the executives.
But they've got to want to do this because there's no regulation, there's no governing body, so they don't have to.
Correct.
What we're doing here is a step in the right direction. We need to make sure that people are aware of that people are asking for this. I mean, Google has done what they've done, again, just as an example, because people ask for a clean search. I don't want my kids to type anything on Google search and find bad stuff. So they've done it because we asked for it. The public asked for it. So we need to do the same thing when it comes to social media. They already have a lot of heat on them. And same thing with Apple, same thing with Google when it comes to their smartphones, to let You know, people measure how much time they're spending online, but what they need to take the next step. They need to open the platform and let other companies play along.
So I want to go back to where we were starting to go a moment ago. There was a time when if you would have said smartphone, I would have said, what the hell are you talking about? I wouldn't have had any idea. And so what's the next thing that's coming out, the thing after that?
Well, you mentioned holograms earlier, and I think yeah, we're all looking forward to sort of seeing Princess Leia, you know, appear on our desk in front of us, which is actually maybe not the Princess Leia part, but the holograms are definitely just a couple years away from being commercially viable to the point where you can actually use them, and they're being tested. I've seen a couple of the tests. It's actually really cool.
Could there be a HAL hologram? Wait a minute. Hologram?
Yeah.
Hologram.
Yeah.
Yeah. There we go.
The other big thing, of course, is VR and AR, so virtual reality and augmented reality, which, again, is going to become, if we think that we're addicted to our devices now, once you're in this other...
Especially when you combine them.
Right.
When you bring the two of those together into environment where maybe a gaming environment or even the sports or some sort of training.
Well, that was kind of where I was going. How much more addictive could this become?
Oh, way more.
Way more.
How can it be way more?
So I'll give you an example. Facebook is working on this, on a headset, on your Oculus, which allows you, and part of the software they're actually promoting now, is you can go on vacation anywhere in the world without leaving your home. So you can just be on vacation.
So I look into the headset and I see my feet on the beach in Maui.
Right.
And I get a bucket of water and I throw it on myself.
And you can
and
be there
I feel
with
like
your
a
friends.
Wave just splashed me.
Right. Pretty much. And you, right. Why would you ever want to come back home, right? And you're with your friends there, not literally on this VR world, which is a lot of fun and it's great. But we need to learn also how to control it, or people will simply die of starvation because you're not eating.
Inattention, basically,
yes.
Yeah. But I think there's another piece of that, which is that as these technologies start to grow, it allows us all to do things together in ways that maybe we could never do before. So something like virtual reality or augmented reality suddenly allows multiple players around the world to maybe perform a surgery or to do something really positive. You know, this is the other side of it, is how can these technologies be used to better ourselves and to make the world a better place? And there's actually a lot of, you know, tech people who kind of semi-joke about technology for good. Because, you know, oftentimes we hear only about these bad stories. But it's really like, how do you use these new tools, whether it's in surgery or whether it's investments or, you know, buying a home? But how can you kind of leverage them so that you're still a human being, but then you're using these digital tools to enhance your experience?
So I agree. I mean, it is, technology is not bad. Again, we have to remember that. It's how we use it. So Google Streets, for example, is amazing. I mean, you can look and see, you know, this studio from how it looks from the outdoor. So I can actually, when I'm driving here, I know exactly where
yeah,
I am.
Yeah, Google Earth is
right.
Great.
It's amazing.
I mean, there's, yeah.
So if I can do the same thing in virtual reality, it's great. So there's nothing wrong with the technology. My worry is that people, you know, naturally just tend to become addicted to stuff.
Well, and they become
fun.
Introverted, and they become more withdrawn and more
yes.
within themselves.
Right.
Sociology, then.
Well, I'm actually on a different page than these guys. I mean, the AR and virtual reality, these are very sexy technologies, and, you know, it's fun to talk about them. But I actually don't think that that's where the big play is going to be. At this point, a lot of that is of interest to basically young male gamers, and it's not a mainstream play at this point in time or anywhere in the near future. What I think the big play is these digital assistants. You know, the Hey Googles, Alexas, and all this. This kind of interaction with a digital agent is something that little kids are going to grow up just depending upon. It's just like another person to them. You're talking to Alexa, or you're talking to your friend or your dad. So this idea that these sort of embedded artificial intelligences are going to pervade through other parts of our lives, in our cars, perhaps it's a refrigerator, who knows what it could be, but what we're giving up is, you know, possibly privacy and things like that, and also skills, in exchange for convenience and someone helping us, like a digital assistant.
And then as robotics takes over,
that's it.
And you have robots out there,
that's
and you have a robot named Alexa,
that's it.
And another one named Siri, and then all of a sudden they get smarter than we are, and then I don't want to go there.
Yeah.
I
think that's where
Judgment
that's
Day.
That's more of a mainstream you know, where more Internet of Things are going to get more intelligent, it's going to spread through more of our daily lives, as opposed to the AR, VR. I think that's a more of a niche thing at this point in time.
Well, let's sort of wrap this up. Let me give each of you an opportunity to sort of sum up your thoughts. We've hit a number of different areas, but, you know, if there's sort of a bottom line, Alan, what would that be?
I think that everybody actually has to take some steps to be their own cybersecurity expert. I mean, you can't always go hire a company. If you're using a device, you have to learn how to use it, and you have to learn how to protect yourself. You have to learn what are the settings. You know, what can I do to actually protect myself? And then expand that. So if you have a family and you have kids and they're using devices, well, what do I have to do for my kids? Also, if you have parents who are older than you, they may not know how to use the technology quite as well. So it's really important to be able to work with, you know, the people who do understand the technology, really work with the older generations to teach them, because especially elderly people can really be very susceptible to different types of scams just because something's flashing in their face or they don't really know what to click on because of the way the website's designed. But then beyond that, I think that it's also kind of an awareness, you know, that yes, we should use these things, but also turn them off sometimes. Walk away from the device, put it down, go hiking, you know, and don't let it be something where, you know, if there's five people in the room and you have a choice, you're looking at your phone or talking to the five people, well, you should really be talking to the five people, not looking at your phone.
Right. So I think that we need to protect the most precious resource we have, which is time. I mean, there are only 24 hours in a day. And we need to be very smart, both for us as, you know, as adults, as parents, as well as with our kids, and definitely, you know, lead by good example. I mean, it's not okay for us to just consume nonstop. Definitely, when it comes to kids, they're growing in a new reality where they don't know anything else. They were born with these, you know, smart devices in their hands because we wanted to take a break from life and just, you know, have a nice cup of coffee. So it's not about scaring anyone. It's about let's leverage technology in the right way.
But we do have to become smarter than our smartphone.
Yes, we need to be smarter. We need to be more responsible. We need to leverage technology. And Unglue can be one of them. But there are many solutions out there that help you better manage your time. I mean, this is what we need to teach. If we're smart as parents, we teach our kids how to manage money.
What would Unglue do?
Well, it will help you teach your kids how to manage their own time.
That's an app?
That's an app, yes.
So you download that, and what does it do when you open it?
It will allow you as a parent to set limits for your kids.
And then do you as the owner know everything about me?
No. It's about parents and kids, but it allows you to see how much time they spend. It allows them to see how much time they spend.
But can you collect that data?
So we collect only time data. We don't collect any other data other than
so
time.
So you take the position that privacy is important, and absolutely, the information that you could be getting, shut the door on.
Yes, we're only focusing on time. This is for us the most important problem we're having, where the addiction comes from, and we're here to help the next generation, you know, Gen Z as we call them, to better learn how to manage their time.
What happens when we run out of the alphabet? We don't have Gen Z. What's after Z?
Numbers.
I know.
Numbers one.
We'll see.
I'm noticing a kid out here in the waiting area looking at a device as we're speaking right now.
Right. You have a book.
I do have a book. It's called Left to Their Own Devices, coming out in February. And I've been thinking a lot about these issues. And, you know, one thing that occurs to me is we're sort of writing the body out of the equation. You know, we are evolved social creatures, embodied creatures, and a lot of what happens now with these devices is sort of passive entertainment, passive taking in of information. And I would like to see, and one of the things that we're seeing, by the way, in the universities is higher than ever levels of anxiety and depression and things like that. So this idea of bringing the body back into the equation, going out in nature, doing physical things like sports or playing instruments and things like that, I think we're missing out on a lot of that now. And I'd like to see, you know, some quiet time spent in nature to rejuvenate. Other generations did that all the time.
In other words, take a hike and leave your smartphone at home.
Yeah.
But then how would you know how many miles you walked? How long?
There you go. You wouldn't have a pedometer with you.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I tell you, we're hooked.
Hook, line, and sinker. We're left to our own devices.
Well, the bottom line is there's a lot of this that's a little mind-blowing, mind-boggling. And all you're left to be able to say at the end of the day is, ready, everybody? What the hell?
What the hell?
So a big thank you to Julie Albright, a digital sociologist and lecturer at USC. Alon Schwartz, who's the founder of Unglue, an app that helps you limit computer screen time. And Alan Silberberg, the CEO of cybersecurity firm DigiJax. That was a good conversation. Hope you'll subscribe. If you haven't already, just go to your podcast provider, whether it's iTunes, Google Play, or somebody else, and just subscribe. And if you have the time, give us 5 stars, make some nice comments. We always like to read those. Thanks for joining us, and see you next time. What the hell?